Hey there, it's Wednesday, October 6th at 2:06 in the afternoon. You're listening to the Mincing Rascals, and this is John Hansen doing my best impersonation of John Williams that I can possibly do. I'll be filling in while he's over the pond for the next couple of weeks. Thanks so much for joining us. You can listen to me on WGN radios on and off throughout the weeks, and also on Saturday afternoons with Let's Get Legal.
I'm Brandon Pope, Everyday Magazine and WCIU.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Eric Zorn on the Sky bandwagon, and I'm the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter.
And you're in front of a bunch of gourds. It's spooky season for Eric Zorn.
It's decorative gourd season.
John Williams would have said something like, "You're looking gorgeous today."
Oh, well, so yeah. I don't take the low-hanging gourds like that. I leave those where they are. You mentioned the Sky. We'll talk a little bit later on, because I know Brandon Pope's going to the game tonight, and hopefully the Sky can get to the WNBA finals. But I wanted to talk about Facebook and Instagram and their big outage earlier this week. I was of the impression for a long time of how wonderful this was. I was reminded of the scene of The Simpsons where all the children escape out to the outside for the first time in a long time. And then a lot of people yelled at me saying that they are vital components to people's communications. Where do you guys land on no Facebook for 6 or 7 hours? We'll start with you, Austin.
I do think it's good to have, similar to intermittent fasting, periods where you cannot physically access those things. So I think it maybe was a net plus for society just for those brief 6 hours. It could not have come at a worse time for Facebook. They're kind of in the crosshairs of the federal government, as they kind of have been for the past 4 or 5 years. And today, I believe there's even more hearings today. I saw a tweet that really freaked me out from Senator Kirsten Gillibrand in New York, who's talking about a dedicated regulatory agency for Facebook and other big tech companies, quote, to hold them accountable for how their algorithm pushes misinformation and how our data is used and misused for their profit. I don't think a federal misinformation agency is a good idea. And I think we have many episodes in history to point to prove that. So, socially, I would say a lot of my job is dependent on those two platforms. So it wasn't great, but it was better than the four month period late last year and early this year, where you literally could not run any ad with any political message or social message, which included, if you're working at a nonprofit that helps the homeless, for example, you could not run ads because they were seen as political and social. So the government and these companies, not in a conspiratorial way, but these companies really do have to respond to political incentives now because of this threat of them being broken up.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think we ought to impose a weekly Facebook Sabbath in which there's this period in which it is offline and we're forced to interact with people. Somebody on Twitter said that it was very difficult yesterday because she didn't know who was feeling blessed.
That's real.
But to get to the broader point that we're talking about with the Facebook being under fire and the 60 Minutes episode the other night, there seems to be a fairly strong consensus left and right that we need to do something about Facebook. But I think that's as far as it gets, that there's not a lot of agreement on what that something would be. I saw some moves like maybe we ought to make sure that nobody under 18 has Facebook, but I'm not sure that might address one little problem, but I don't see how you, when you have a platform with, what is it, 300 million users? Is that the figure they're knocking around? If only Heather would know.
It's more than that. Yes, Heather would know.
Heather would know exactly. But when you have that many people posting that often, you can't have an army of people who are reading and approving and monitoring all the content that's out there. So I don't know what it is that they are proposing to do. The idea that they would hold Facebook responsible as a publisher, the way you would hold the Chicago Tribune responsible or WGN Radio or CIU responsible for what is given to the public, what is aired, what is printed. If you did that with Facebook, they'd have to close down because people libel others all the time and they do it instantaneously. It's not like you submit something to Facebook for approval. You just post it. And so I don't know. Does anyone have any thoughts as to what we should do? Because I know that there's a feeling we should do something, but what is that something?
Well, I know it was suggested by the woman who was the whistleblower testifying of some sort of overhaul or reform of this thing called Section 230, which basically her idea would be to find a way to make it to where you can hold Facebook accountable for their algorithm and for, you know, whatever they're doing that's allowing misinformation to rise itself to the top. But here's the thing. We've been hearing about Facebook misinformation problem for years now, it feels like. It feels like an eternity. It's a constant problem, and no one's come up with a concrete solution. If that's what we got to do is review the old codes we have and structure those, I say go for it. But I'm not hearing any good plans right now to do much about it other than saying, hey, Facebook's bad. Let's all get together and do something. I was happy to see a little break. I barely get on Facebook as it is. You know, I didn't have friends from high school hitting me up about you know, their pyramid schemes they want me to get involved in or nothing. That felt great to get a refresh from that. You know, so I say it's fine to go without Facebook, but overall, we got to think about how many users are on this globally and the amount of things Facebook owns. Instagram, WhatsApp. There are countries that depend on WhatsApp for messaging, like India and Asia. I can only imagine what that shutdown did to them. It just, like, impacted their whole entire lives, or for us, it probably just, like, was a small inconvenience.
For me, it's like when there isn't a plan that's present and everyone talks about it, it's probably best not to do anything in general. That's usually what I feel. I think that we're talking about large society issues, right? We talk about a lot of teenage girls specifically have terrible body image when they use Instagram. We're talking about broad things like vaccine misinformation being spread. How can any government agency or any group try and police that in any way? I mean, these are big, broad issues that are more society-based. I think Facebook is just kind of the way these problems manifest themselves in a little bit, in a way.
Yeah, I agree. And there's 2.9 billion with a B active Facebook users.
Whoa!
In the world. 2.9 billion. So Eric's point about content moderation is completely correct. I think the solution's ultimately going to be technological. I don't think there's going to be any policy solution to most of these problems. But to Eric's point about there is bipartisan skepticism of Facebook, but where you really see this very concerning party divide, and it's very, very, very recent, is on whether the U.S. government should take steps to restrict online information, even if it limits, you know, freedom of speech. Pew did research on this. In 2018, 40% of Democrats and 37% of Republicans said the U.S. government should take steps to restrict false information online, even if it limits freedom of information. Fast forward to 2021, that's gone from 40% of Democrats to 65% of Democrats, and it went from 37% of Republicans to 28%. The people in charge of the federal government changed. And when you're on one side, imagine Democrats rightly thought that when Trump was in charge of the federal government, that we shouldn't give the federal government more power to say what constitutes misinformation online. And just because your guy is in doesn't mean that that's not still a threat, because guess what? He's not going to be president forever.
Do you think, though, that part of that is just what COVID has done, and then the insane passage of information in 2020 and now 2021, whether it's about the virus itself or the vaccines, that give a lot of Democrats and maybe others as well, although you said the Republican number went down, just concern, just watching it in their own real lives of people sharing things, their friends, their aunts, their uncles?
Oh, it totally could be that there's more, they see more information that could be consequential for public health. But I think a massive factor is the fact that, oh, well, the people who we're giving this power to, it's a Democratic-controlled federal government.
So, Austin, do you believe that anyone should be able to post whatever the heck you want? I mean, in terms of minus incredible, hateful, or violent stuff? I mean, like misinformation, wrong facts, and just let the marketplace of ideas sort it out?
Yeah. I don't know how many of you go on 4chan or ever did, but yes. It's terrible. It's like a terrible experience. I don't know why anyone would want to go do it. So people don't have a demand for an anarchic free-for-all on the internet. They want a platform where they can see what their friends are doing, they see interesting information, they can watch content. Like, people, and the amazing thing is, if you have free competition of those things, better experiences for users will typically win, which is why, like, 4chan isn't really where your mom is hanging out most of the time. So, yeah, I think the market should decide what social platforms allow or don't. And whenever you give that power to a government, you're going to get really, really bad outcomes.
Eric, I got to know your thought. I mean, can my uncle share that the vaccine's going to make you grow another head on your shoulders? Like,
well, I mean, the only thing worse than him posting that is a government that is looking over his shoulder, telling him what he can and can't post. I mean, it's a dilemma. But even if we could do that, which I don't think that we could. I don't think you could logistically have any kind of social media platform where there is that kind of editing. I mean, they talk about getting rid of, I mean, if you got rid of the immunity that these platforms have for being sued for what's been put on them, then you'd get rid of Facebook. Facebook would go bankrupt in a heartbeat because you can post all kinds of nonsense on Facebook. They probably need to up their game a little bit with the number of people they have reviewing. That would be my choice, would be to tell them, look, invest some of these billions that you're making from your, what is it, 2.9 billion people? Invest some of the money that you're making from them and off them into a far more robust content moderation system where you were things that are false, and do that in the private market. Let Facebook decide. They already do that with things like pornography and, mm-hmm. and suicide videos and violent videos. They have the tools in place to make decisions, and I don't really have a problem if Facebook says we are going to say that you can't write about vaccines in a negative way. That's up to if Facebook wants to do it. That doesn't violate the First Amendment. That's Facebook doing it. If the government tells Facebook that it can't post about vaccines, that is where I have a problem. And I expect that certainly Austin would have a problem with that.
Oh yeah,
right. So what the interesting thing that's happening now, which I think is tough for like liberals with like a lowercase L, people really believe in the First Amendment, is that we're in this weird space where there's a lot of soft power being exerted by the government on these platforms. So there's, you know, a difference perhaps in the government saying, you cannot post this word on Facebook, and the government saying to Facebook, don't post this word. By the way, there's 50 senators behind me who want to break you up, so maybe you should listen to what I have to say. The outcome can be the same, even though the means are different and the force isn't really like center stage very easily. That line is unclear. I think we have to be concerned about both because the outcome kind of is the same either way.
Yeah, I know one thing that probably shouldn't be posted to Facebook or anywhere is following a senator into a bathroom, which some protesters did at the Arizona State University, where Senator Kyrsten Sinema is a guest lecturer. She's, of course, at the middle of the bipartisan infrastructure debate, if they actually would ever talk about it, the actual issues. And protesters on the left following her into the bathroom. She's not the only one. Joe Manchin got kayakers up to his yacht on the Potomac from West Virginia and to chat with him, although he did engage a little bit. Is there a line? I think that President Biden said in his press conference that those antics were, I don't know if he said not appropriate or not good, but he said, but being a public figure, that's what you come to expect. I don't know where the line is. I guess it's just something, you know it when you see it, and the cinema thing was definitely over it.
The line would certainly be at the bathroom door.
If there's any place where there's a line, yes, it would have to be the stall, right?
Yeah.
But in general,
I tend to be sort of an absolutist about this. I think that a public official's home, whether it's a houseboat or an actual home, should be off limits. My principle was tested a little bit during the pandemic when it was difficult to, because they didn't have offices that you could go and protest at. But I think that the home should remain a sanctum, and that if you start subjecting public officials, and now we're down to even school board officials, right, who are getting mm-hmm. hassled. If you start telling people that if you run for office, if you get into public service, whether you want to be a major public figure or a minor public figure, that you are subjecting yourself and your family to being hassled at your home, that you're going to have a lot of people saying, look, it's not worth it. And a lot of good people saying that. And I don't see the utility in being able to hassle somebody in the bathroom or in their home. And I also think that when you do that, you don't really advance your cause. Like, I don't think Sinema's slightly more inclined to support the people who are now bothering her in the bathroom.
Maybe less.
So maybe a little less. Yeah. So
interesting.
I think that public spaces are fair game. You know, if you're walking down the street, Starbucks, fine. But I'm with Eric, though. Your house, going to the bathroom, like, there's clearly... It gets
but you think at like a restaurant or a Starbucks, like if they're ordering, they're eating there with their family, that's okay to...
I think that's fine. I say that's fine because they are public officials. It's a public setting. And if you're going to be an obstructionist in your own party, then hey, that's kind of what comes with the territory. You're going to get some people upset at Starbucks. That's the crowd. Don't go to Starbucks. Get a Keurig.
Shop local. Yeah, I don't know. I see like both sides of it, right? And I also feel like senators are a little used to it. I'm sure she was perturbed, especially into the bathroom thing. And then, of course, she's going to get a little hay out of it, publicity-wise. But, Eric, you brought up such a great point about school boards. And as we continue to see school board meetings as some of the hottest political theater that is happening, these, I mean, school board folks don't have security. They don't have people that can protect them. And a lot of protesters, you know, a lot of them are well-meaning and they have true in their beliefs, but a lot of them are fueled up by what they see posted by other people. I don't want to say they're sent by people. That brings up a lot of George Soros sent you vibes, which I'm not going for, but they are part of groups online, right? Where it's like, let's find these people. Let's go there. I mean, you could really create some dangerous situations.
I do think there's, so for example, a lot of school board members have their phone number, right? Or a personal email address. If you're calling someone in their home, is that crossing a line too? I don't think there's a quite an easy to draw line. I think the home theory might be good, Eric, like showing up at someone's doorstep because their family didn't ask to be, you know, part of this. But I generally am on the side of more contact with elected officials than less. I just don't think the line is so clear in every aspect. Also, do you guys think if you were Joe Manchin, would you talk to the people in kayaks beneath your houseboat knowing they were filming you on a yacht? That seemed like a really wild decision to me.
I know, but he answered a couple questions and did so very respectfully. I think it speaks a lot to the difference between the two senators. Like Joe Manchin, love him or hate him, has definitely said what he feels. I think he likes the microphone a little bit, but he also has told you what he wants in the reconciliation package or in the debt ceiling package. He had a press conference. Well, I shouldn't say press conference. He didn't take questions, but at least he spoke to reporters, whereas Sinema is refusing to say much of anything. Now, she doesn't like negotiating with the press, and that's probably true in many ways, but to not offer anything to reporters or people walking the halls of Congress or her constituents who voted her in, I think that in a way, she's asked a little bit for it, not for the bathroom line, but I think that that's why she's getting it.
Well, it doesn't help her at all. I mean, Manchin is explaining why he can't get to this big number that the left wants. He's explaining the impact on his area. He's explaining his own qualms with, you know, spending and debt and the country's issues there. And Sinema is doing the complete opposite. She's just like, I don't like it. And not giving any reason. So when you don't give any reason, giving any context, it makes you look like you're literally just being stubborn. And people are going to get in your face and confrontational about that.
Sure. Yeah. Speaking of confrontation, Kim Fox and Mayor Lightfoot kind of trading barbs this week over, well, a lot of criticism that Kim Fox has gotten about who she chooses to prosecute or who her office chooses to prosecute or not, came to a head after a fatal West Side shooting over in the recent days involving cross gunfire. The police themselves seemed to indicate that they couldn't clearly identify who had shot first, when or where. But the mayor is saying that Kim Fox should have gone further and at least looked at it personally to try and at least issue some charges in this case. I guess, more amazed that this came out so publicly and how open the two were about their disdain or at least disagreement about how each other are handling their jobs. Eric, what'd you think about it?
Well, of course, none of us are in the position to know exactly what evidence they have. And Kim Fox has decided that she doesn't have enough evidence to go forward, I assume, on some serious charges. This was it looked like one faction of a gang was shooting up the house where another faction of a gang was. And of course, when you have these situations, you may have video, but you're never going to get any of these people to testify against one another.
And one person was killed, I should say, in that too.
Oh, one person was killed. Yep. And so like they could have some grounds for some minor charges, some gun charges, but you may not be able to figure out exactly who was doing what, when, to whom. And there was this idea that was floated with that was a mutual combat situation where both parties were part of this. And in those kind of situations, it's very hard to make charges stick, evidently. And so, and I guess the police department, the police detective who was in charge of this said that they didn't have enough evidence to file more serious charges. So I understand Lightfoot's frustration, and Kim Fox clapped back and said, well, this is really just a symptom of the inability of our city to get the crime problem under control. And so it got kind of nice and nasty there.
I think it can be tough with one case to kind of assign blame. Just as Eric said, like, we don't know all the facts in this case. But I keep going back to, because this is really the best data we have, that Tribune piece from last year, I think it was published in August, where they showed number of felony cases dropped from Alvarez to Kim Fox. And it is the case that Kim Fox was dropping a higher percentage. It was a little over 8% of homicide cases she was dropping versus Alvarez dropping 5.3%. If you look at those numbers, it's hard to look at them and say, oh, this is just the change in the state's attorney's office. Like, there's a big change in the quality of information that police are bringing to bring these charges. There is something in that office culturally that has shifted a bit with these. And we can see that in the data. It's hard to see on that case-by-case basis, but it seems pretty clear from the overall data that these charges are being brought at least a little bit less than her predecessor.
Well, we can confirm that Lightfoot and Fox are going to meet and talk this out, which I think is great. That's supposed to happen this week. What's unfortunate is this is not the first time this has happened. This back and forth, this finger pointing, whose fault is it anyway? It's on everybody, right? And so at this point, I think people don't want to see this finger pointing publicly in the press back and forth. Who is to blame for what? Who has culpability here or there? They just want to see the bleeding stop. They want to see all of this come to an end. And so it's really on all Chicagoans, including Lightfoot, Fox, Brown, to come to the table, get together, and stop finger pointing. Stop blaming each other and just get a solution, because it's ridiculous out here.
It's not like Mayor Lightfoot doesn't understand what needs to be brought to go to trial. I mean, she's a former federal prosecutor herself. Yeah. I think that there's been this groundswell for months about the how Kim Fox's office has handled things. And I just wonder if the mayor saw an opportunity, especially with a case with someone dead, a high-profile case, gunshots fired on lots of people in action, to kind of take this case and, I guess, shift some of the blame off of her, shift some of the heat and say that, well, the public has already identified who their scapegoat might be. If I don't jump on this soon, they may change their mind and blame me instead.
But at the same time, sounding condescending doing it, you know? I mean, the way she went about it, you know, just reeked of like, well, I think I know a little more about the law than you do. Or you didn't look into this hard enough. You didn't do your job well enough. And once you go, it's a bad look. It's a bad look for any politician to do that, especially Lightfoot at this moment. At this point, people don't want to see, people aren't concerned about whose fault it really is. They're looking at all three of these people, Fox, Brown, and Lightfoot, and saying, what are you doing to fix this? And right now, neither of the three have done anything to curb this bleeding.
Well, and also Judge Evans is implicated in a lot of these conversations as well. Definitely. There's a question of who is doing what. And yeah, Brandon is exactly right that people in the city, residents, are looking for answers, not bickering. And they would like to, I like the idea that Fox and Lightfoot, and maybe if you get Preckwinkle and Judge Evans and Sheriff Dart and Police Superintendent Brown, get them all together and talk about solutions and steps forward rather than pointing fingers. This one incident was awful, but it's not like if they solve that crime or lock those people up that you're going to really get a handle on things. So, I mean, I do respect Kim Fox's desire to have a fairly high threshold of proof and not just bring charges. That was one of the things that we saw in earlier generations, which is that when you had a high profile case or a heater case, they would charge people based on very flimsy evidence. And we got away from that. Now we may have gone too far. I don't know the evidence in this case. It looks to me as though they probably could have charged at least with some gun offenses, some of these people, but We'll see. But I think there, we want to get a sense, the citizens want to get a sense of all of our public officials pulling on the same oars or going in the same direction.
I really wonder, there's been a lot about the argument that, well, you know, Kim Fox's office isn't charging enough people for enough crimes, too many people are going to let go, and now criminals think they can get away with anything. I think that's a really oversimplistic view. I don't know if that's, I mean, I don't know if the four of us can put our minds inside of a hardened street criminal, but I don't think that they look at, like, they're not looking at the same report that Austin did, right? Like, the data points that are coming out. That may be like one angle of it, but do you think that that has a direct effect on people thinking that they can get away scot-free for things?
I think perception is reality. So I think, like, while, like, maybe they're not reading that Tribune article, there is, especially for narcotics, which generally I'm a huge opponent of the drug war, but this is a massive change. So under Alvarez, 34% of narcotics charges were dropped. Under Fox, 54% of narcotics charges were dropped. That's a really, really big spread.
Does that include marijuana and, like, just the general changes that we've had overall?
No, because the charges still have to be brought, right? So if someone is legally smoking marijuana, true, that's not going to show up in this data. It's going to be more like really large amounts of drugs, which it's likely easier to bring charges on some of that stuff sometimes than maybe some other stuff that those people are doing that is harder to prove, right? That is an actual change that would be perceptible if I know 10 people who might be charged on narcotics charges. You know, three of them would not have charges last time versus half of them wouldn't, you know, under Fox. I do think that is potentially being perceived.
Amongst the people you know, right? Exactly.
Well, and wouldn't it be the case that there are fewer people being charged in general with drug crimes now that marijuana has been legalized, yes, and normalized? So that statistic is maybe even a little bit more striking than what the numbers would indicate.
Go ahead, Brandon.
Well, I was going to say, I do think it's interesting that Lightfoot chose to target Kim Fox in particular here when the police even admitted to their own with the investigation they had, they didn't have a thorough enough investigation to get the evidence they needed to bring enough charges. That it really came down to the police work on the ground. They arrested a bunch of people, but didn't actually get down to the heart of the details of what happened. And they were hoping a jury could kind of sort it out from there. And that is not how it works. And this is a police department that has nationally abysmal clearance rates when it comes to arrests, when it comes to convictions. So it feels like it's even misdirection for Lightfoot to go after Kim Fox on this, when really it started from the police work on the ground.
I wonder if I'm taking too simplistic of a view of this, but I often worry that there's just a contradiction in what people want and their dream scenario for what a city is, and then the reality that some of those dreams have. For instance, the idea of not charging drug offenders as strictly, right? Like, that sounds great, right? Like, there should be more treatment instead of enforcement. Let's stop recidivism by really limiting the number of people that go to jail for minimal crimes and see if what we can do to build them up better. But there is there's action and reaction, right? And that's why I wonder, is some of this hired crime, while it's not something that is palatable, is a natural reaction to some of these things, these policies that were pushed by people that wanted to proclaim a just society. I don't know how else to describe it. Like, you get the crime bill in 94 and then crime goes down. Not saying that those two are directly linked, but they are very strong. But is anyone advocating for a crime bill like the 94 crime bill to fight this crime? No, because that is, you know, I guess, am I making sense what I'm worried about? No.
I think I get where you're coming from. You have to be tough on crime, a tough on crime approach. But the tough on crime approach of the 90s had some really devastating consequences. So what we need now is tough on crime with heart, with empathy, something that kind of, that sounds weird, right?
I know. And that's why I wonder if, like, what we're wondering, like, the society we're trying to build is like this is impossible to get.
I think it's possible. I'm not an expert in law enforcement, though, but I think it's completely possible to have a society where you can focus on restorative justice, still have punishment for really serious crimes, but also focus on, you know, treating humans as humans and, you know, weeding out bias and weeding out things like that, and not letting one mistake ruin an entire person's life if it is something like a drug offense or something, you know, smaller and not nonviolent. So I think there's a place for that for sure. And I think Chicago is trying to get there, right? It's just tough to do that when you got this crazy violence problem going on right now that's going to require some really, really tough choices and tough decisions in how we do policing.
Yeah, I just want to add that if you kill your mother and stuff her into a suitcase, you probably ought to spend more than 10 years in prison.
That's definitely.
Yeah. I'll just throw that out there.
So. Yeah, for those that don't know, we're talking about the murder of the Heather Mack story, right?
Yeah, she's getting released from prison over in Indonesia, right?
And I think most people agree that there has to be justice. Right. And the problem with what is happening right now, where we have homicide rates only matched by the mid-90s, really, in Chicago history, is that, to Brandon's point about the clearance rate, there's thousands of families in the city that do not receive justice from their government and their victims of many of these shootings, because crime is not being solved. And oftentimes, even if, even if there is evidence, charges are being dropped. And so I think that kind of shifts this like right-left paradigm of tough on crime versus soft on crime. It's no, you have to be, lawlessness is something that hurts everyone, especially the most vulnerable communities in the city. And that comes from a lack of justice. And that comes from a bunch of different factors. It's the police department not implementing the most basic reforms they need to be effective from the consent decree. It may come from the state's attorney's office not bringing cases that they should.
So you're suggesting, and I think you're right, is that the more murders you solve, while it might be a lagging indicator, the less murders are going to happen.
Yeah. If I only have a 30% chance of getting caught for killing someone in my neighborhood, versus yeah. have a 70% chance of being caught, that matters.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned crime in the 90s. Ken Griffin, of course, our richest person here in the state of Illinois, threatening to move Citadel from Chicago because of the violence that has been occurred. We should note that he opened the office when there was 800 homicides in a year, one of the most violent years of all, and Governor Pritzker clapped back a little bit, saying, well, Ken Griffin brought you Bruce Rauner, and Bruce Rauner didn't pass a budget that helped violence prevention programs from happening in social services. So a little back and forth between these two gentlemen. Do you think that someone like Ken Griffin is serious? Do you think that other people, whether it's big businesses, small businesses, are really making decisions right now based on the violence to move in or out of the city, Eric? Do you think that's the conversation that's happening?
I think it's a real risk as when you have the kinds of crimes that we're seeing, the kinds of avenue, the sorts of crimes that you're seeing, such as the carjackings and the shootings that are taking place on the expressways. I think when crime was felt more localized, when you felt like you could be safe on Michigan Avenue, you could be safe on the expressway, if you no longer feel that way, I do think that it is a disincentive. I thought Ken Griffin's remarks were over the top, comparing Chicago to Afghanistan. On the other hand, I think it is
Afghanistan on its best day, he said.
On its best day. Okay. Well then. My sense is that it's a problem for getting people to come live here. It's going to also be a problem to get people to come visit here. That you can say, well, we have this great city and we're ranked really high in the Condé Nast traveler rankings. We're the number one city in the country. But are tourists going to want to come here if they are afraid? If you can't walk around the loop at night on a warm summer evening because they're roving gangs of kids are going to knock you down and take your cell phone? I think these are serious issues that we need to talk about because it is the lifeblood of the city is the employment here and the tourism that we bring here. And if we start losing those, it's going to be a downward spiral.
And I think it's totally legit, the concerns that he brought up. And I actually appreciated the fact that someone was asking what the governor was doing about this issue for once. And he's completely left out of many of these conversations, even though Chicago's the economic driver of the state. And his success as governor depends on the success of Chicago. And he should be far more involved and far more outspoken about violence in Chicago. And I think it's probably going to be one of the biggest issues he contends with in his reelection campaign. Condé Nast, a lot of people are touting that study or touting that survey, right? I think it was mm-hmm. for the fifth year in a row, best place to visit. Chicago is the best place in America. It's the greatest city in America. It is perhaps the worst governed city in America. And there's a big difference in criticizing those two things. When people say, oh man, he's just slamming Chicago. He just hates Chicago. No, he's talking about a policy response that's done by its elected officials. He's not talking about riverboat cruises aren't good. He's not talking about how Chicago doesn't have great people. Chicago doesn't have great cuisine. Like, Chicago has all these amazing things. It's the best in so many things. It is the worst when it comes to its governance.
Do you think people are too sensitive to when he says something like that and wants to leave and don't take it as a policy insult, but instead...
100%. Look at Pritzker's response. It was all an ad hominem attack about the guy who said it, right? It had nothing... He didn't talk about violence in the city, like, which you expect when you go, when someone goes after you personally like that. But,
and Griffin did give him an opening because Griffin accused him of saying that he didn't care if kids were killed. He wasn't going to call out the National Guard, when in fact he did call out the National Guard last year during the protest. I don't know what Griffin seemed to have his timeline or his facts screwed up, and perhaps his memory was all wrong. But he made a pretty severe accusation against Pritzker that doesn't seem to be true. So I understand why Pritzker would get his back up about that. I also think that, I mean, you're right, Austin, that the crime in Chicago, crime in general, is part of a governor's responsibility, but he's really not on the front lines of it. The governor is not. That's really the mayor, and it's the state's attorney, and it's the judges, it's the sheriff. It's, if you're talking about crime in Chicago, Pritzker is not on the front lines of that, and our system is not made up for him to be that way.
But he probably should be. I guess that's the argument from Ken Griffin. And, you know, you can question Ken Griffin's motives here. He sounded like a guy throughout that entire Economic Club, you know, interview that wants to run for governor. He said he has no political intentions, but it seemed pretty pointed. And it seemed pretty – he had a lot of things to run down, and he ran through them pretty fast and pretty well. You know, the issue here is safety, ultimately. And it goes more than to just Citadel possibly leaving. There are people that talk about leaving the city for good just because they don't feel safe in their neighborhoods. They don't feel safe anymore. Right? Maybe 10 years ago, 20 years ago, they felt safer than what they do now. And so now that they have families or kids, they just don't think they can raise their kids in this city. That's a big concern for Chicago. If you have people are constantly leaving the city already, the census shows population dropping, especially amongst minorities, especially black millennials. They leave in droves to cities like Indianapolis, Detroit. They go to Arizona. They go to California. And that is often because of the crime in the city. So it's a problem that Pritzker should do less ad hominem attacks on and more looking in the mirror and saying, hey, what can we do from a state perspective to support Chicago and help rid this issue? Because Austin's spot on. Chicago is basically what powers Illinois. When we think about Illinois, it's Chicago.
And he touted, I mean, in the last spring session, a major accomplishment that he touted over and over was criminal justice reform and he signed those bills in Chicago. So, yeah, the governor's office has a big responsibility to public safety in Chicago. It's the biggest public policy issue in your biggest economic driver as a state is the violence problem in Chicago right now.
Austin, though, but I mean, you don't want government getting at our Facebook feeds and a top-down approach from government never works. What do you want the governor to do?
He has to put together a plan that brings together city, county, and state. Mm-hmm. Go out and just like he did with, remember how involved he was with COVID and the pandemic? Day after day, press conference after press conference. Here's what we're doing. Here's our measurements of success. I've not seen the governor do anything like that when it comes to public safety in Chicago, and it warrants that kind of response. Now, I'm not in favor of bringing in SWAT teams on every corner. Like there's such thing as a bad response to public safety problems, but you have to show leadership from the governor's office. That's the biggest thing I feel like that's missing on this issue.
Yeah. Brandon, you were mentioning people leaving Chicago. I know you have to leave this conversation here soon, but I wanted to give you a chance. You got the Sky you're covering tonight, and obviously a lot of eyes in Chicago are going to be on the Sox tomorrow and the start of the playoffs, but this is huge for the Sky being one game away from the WNBA Finals.
One big away from the WNBA Finals in Candace Parker, the hometown hero's first season coming back. This is pivotal. And there's already, there were some rumors put out there this week about Candace Parker potentially retiring after this season. I think that was put out there by Connecticut people to try to give some sort of distraction to the locker room. Candace Parker ain't retiring. She's still playing at the top level, and I'm hoping the team is focused for tonight. But it should be a great game. These past few games have been intense. Last one went to overtime, so this is going to be one to watch in Wintrust. So you can make it out. Tickets are pretty cheap, actually, only about $40.
They're an awfully fun team to watch. I'm coming to enjoy the WNBA more and more. And Courtney Vandersloot's performance in was it the first game, was it, of the playoffs, where she did a triple double, and she was dishing passes like between people's legs. It was really a phenomenal thing to see. Very exciting team. I hope for the best for them. And I don't follow the WNBA, I admit, during the regular season, so I have no idea whether they'll be favored or even close to favored in the playoffs should they make the finals. They were, I think, a sixth seed. Is that right, yeah. Brandon? You might know this.
They were Heather, a sixth seed. Yeah,
Heather would know if she were here. But,
they're definitely a sixth seed versus the Connecticut's one seed. So it's an upset of sorts. But the argument's always been this team was built for playoff basketball, and it's showing itself. They've powered through. And if they can get to the finals, what an incredible story for James Wade, the head coach. Great for Chicago. The best basketball team in the city is the Sky.
Although the Bulls looked good in their preseason game last night. But I agree with Eric. I was into the season early on, and it faded from my thought process. And then I saw Annie Constable of the Sun-Times tweet that only she was the only press person, and I'm not calling anyone else out here in this conversation, to show up for a media availability that they had in the playoffs. And I wonder if, and I thought it was great for Annie to do that. She's been covering the team really well this season. But I do think that there's something about the finals that can get people into it, right? Like when you're only, it's a best of five format, I believe, you're three wins from a championship. I don't know. I think that is something juicy that people might be able to chew on versus, like you were saying, Eric, and a lot of people regular season and even the early postseason too.
And I want to give some reporters a little bit of, you know.
It was a Saturday morning, I think.
Yeah, and also I don't think the Sky team, press team does a great job.
Okay.
Your teams do when it comes to informing about these things. So I give some people a pass. It is tough to track down when these pressers are, unlike other teams in the city. But yeah, this is a team that deserves support. And yeah, I mean, the finals on the line, a championship. We could have a championship parade in Chicago again. I'm pumped.
Yeah. Austin is wearing his St. Louis Cardinals hat. They have a one-game playoff against the Los Angeles Dodgers tonight. At one point, they won 17 games in a row. I was reading St. Louis Cardinals message boards in May, which I don't often do, but it was when the Cubs were kind of beating up on the Cardinals. The Cubs were 10 games up, and St. Louis fans sounded like Chicago fans. Like, this team sucks. Sell them all. They're two games under, and here they are against the Dodgers tonight. Austin, are you from the central part of the state? Why are you a Cardinals fan?
Yeah, all my dad's family is all from the Effingham area, which is basically Champaign is, I would say, half and half, if you guys would agree with that. Yeah. And everyone south of there is kind of all Cardinals fans. So, yeah, my dad's family is from down there, and I grew up rooting for the Cardinals. And I actually saw Albert Pujols' last game as a Cardinal, which is Game 7 of the World Series, in St. Louis, and he is going to play tonight in this one game playoff.
That's like, awesome.
So that's pretty cool. I'm hoping for the best.
What about the Sox?
Yeah, okay. I was going around the horn and leaving our newest Sox fan, Eric Zorn. You excited? I don't want to say newest, but
I may be the only Sox fan on this panel. Brandon seems like the kind of guy who's like open minded and will.
Brandon is a Sox fan. I can say this now that he left. When the Sox give him tickets to go to the game.
Now wait a second. Okay,
came back for that.
They are my adopted Chicago team. I will admit.
Okay, well then
that's how I feel the same way.
So okay, so what is your prediction in this
game? They're going to beat the Astros in this series. I am worried about what they're going to do going forward, but they're going to win at least this series.
I love this team, but I think the Astros in four.
Yeah, wow. Go ahead,
John. You know the Tony La Russa versus Dusty Baker.
Who that's wins a good matchup
all the time?
Yeah,
Tony.
Yeah, it is.
Almost,
it is
almost hands down, right?
It is Tony, except for one 5-game series I remember in 2003. Although 2003 feels like what those two managers should be managing in, not 2021, which is crazy. And Dusty Baker, I believe, now is fifth team he's taken to the playoffs, which is a major league record. It'll be interesting. I just hate the 5-game divisional series. I've always been a proponent. If you're going to play 162 games, you play 7 in the opening round. I know people are eager to get these World Series going, but I like showing deeper pitching depth. If you have two good starters, you can win a 5-game series, no problem. I always feel like a team should have 3 really to get it, but my Cubbies aren't anywhere close to it. So go White Sox. I will root them on. I'm fine with them winning.
I would agree with you, John, about cutting the season back to,
144. Yeah, 144.
And having longer playoffs. People are really engaged in the playoffs, and boy, by the end of the season, some of those games just seem completely pointless between teams that are out of it. And so I would love to see 7-game playoff series. And even these one-and-done wild card things, I don't care for those. It was really weird last night to see the Red Sox like spraying champagne all over each other. It's like, man, you guys have like so much more to go before you really deserve a champagne bath. But
yeah, I guess there's no perfect answer to it. So in a week, that will be through game 5 games, I believe, of the ALDS. If I'm not mistaken, game 5 might be next Wednesday, but either way, Eric thinks the White Sox will be done. He's going with the Astros. Brandon thinks the White Sox are moving on. Austin, what was your prediction again?
Yeah, White Sox. Go with La Russa, yeah.
Go with La Russa. That's right. Well, we'll find out next week. We'll drop another. Oh, go ahead,
what
Eric.
What was yours, John?
I'll go White Sox in 5.
Okay.
All right. Why not? I'm a White Sox fan now. No, I'm not. I'm not at all. But I will, in good cheer and good spirit for the city, I would love to see it.
One more sports note. One more.
Yeah, please.
Justin Fields is now the star of the Bears going forward.
It was a little weird how this all played out. How Matt Nagy said early in the week that he wasn't going to be, that it was going to be Andy Dalton. It seemed like the sporting world blew up on him and he changed course. Now, I don't know if it was a potential Justin Fields injury that was really driving what the decision was to start him or not, but real strange that he, I don't know. I don't know what I'm more offended by, that he wanted to start Dalton or now that he listened to the press and went the other way.
It was ineptitude. That's what it really was. I'm glad they saw Justin Fields play well on this past Sunday with the Lions. After that performance, there's no way you can go back. So
he said Dalton.
Against the Brandon, it's the Detroit Lions, the most pathetic team in NFL history since the early 60s. I don't know.
They got a lot of fight, though. Those Lions are fighters.
See how he does against the Raiders this Sunday.
It's going to be tough.
The show is speedy when John Hanson hosts instead of John Williams. We'll do it again next week. We're produced by Elif Garris and Ashley Byhun. This is the Mincing Rascals. How does John normally end it? Bye, everyone, and we'll talk soon. So long. Farewell.
We'll drop another pod on you next week.
And we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Okay, with more confidence this time, please.
More confidence? Yeah. We will drop another pod on you next bleeping week. You got it.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.